Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Welcome particularly to the people sitting here in the pews, because getting here this morning was not easy. The roads are blocked everywhere, and with the marathon on. And welcome to everyone joining us via the web camera, particularly anyone who's not feeling the best. Good news, Bill is out of hospital, I think. He was due home yesterday, still on his IV in antibiotics, but making good progress. And we remember as we begin our service those who are not feeling well. And also we keep in our hearts all those suffering from war. We begin with our opening words. Come into this place of peace and let its silence heal your spirit. Come into this place of memory and let its history warm your soul. Come into this place of prophecy and power and let its vision change your heart. Our chalice lighting. At times, as we travel the path of life, we realize we're not sure of the way, the distance or the destination. However, the great gift of life is that we don't travel on our own. We look to one another for wisdom. We're grateful for love and companionship. We can offer one another support and hope. We light our chalice, a symbol of the community that we make together. Our first hymn this morning is hymn number 115, God of Grace and God of Glory.
Thank you.
Let us pray.
We've gathered in this oasis of peace. We come from many places with many different backgrounds. We pause together now to allow ourselves to settle into this place of peace, at this time, in this place, letting the cares of the outside world relax their grip. And we take time to reflect on our presence here. Let us give thanks for all the small moments that make our lives so special. May we recognize in those small moments that divine grace is present at all times, if we are aware of it. We acknowledge with regret those moments when we have been less than we would wish to be, the moments when we have forgotten the divinity within ourselves and within others, the moments when life is hard on us and when we cannot face the world, when our sorrows seem too much to bear. May we have the strength and the courage to affirm that there is divinity in these moments too. May our hearts be turned that we may see divine grace working wherever we look, that we may recognize it and it lighten our burdens, and where we can still see the grace, may we be filled with the spirit of love, grace, compassion, and hope. May we find peace and renewal in this place, and may we take that peace with us into the world in our everyday lives. Amen. Today's service is different. It's different because it's a favourite reading service. It's also been thrown up in the air a bit because we had some musicians lined up and some of them are ill and couldn't come. So it's been a matter of juggling and moving things around. But we're going to have a children's story now. And the children's story is, once upon a time, I don't know, would the children like to come to the front just to hear the story?
We don't make it hard, but it helps the adults because they feel strange, because the best part of the service for them is the children's stories. And the children are trying to come along with the others.
Thank you. Hiya, you're very brave. We don't have an age limit on being children here. This is a once upon a time story, and it was a once upon a time in a village. And things were tough in the village. There wasn't a lot of food around. And it was a farming community. And the way it worked was that different farms produced different vegetables. So one farmer produced onions, the other produced carrots, the other produced leeks. It was all slightly different. Someone else made mushrooms and grew mushrooms. Hiya. And but the weather, things got bad in it and people were poor. And it worked out that the people who grew the onions had a good supply of onions, but nothing else. People who got carrots had a good few carrots, but nothing else. And a visitor came to the village one time and thought about the problem, because everybody was saying, I'm fed up eating carrots, I'm fed up eating leeks, I'm fed up eating mushrooms. And this wise lady came and she thought, I think I can do something about this. And she said to the village, she called a meeting, and she said, you know, I have some magic powers. I can make a fabulous meal for everyone in this village. But you have to do what I tell you to do. So they agreed they would do what she told them. And she, one person did anyway. And she lit a fire in the middle of the village, got a huge big pot, filled it with water. And the person who'd agreed to help her out was the onion seller, came first.
And she says, right, I am going to make a soup with these onions this person has brought along. And they put all the onions in the big pot of water, threw in a bit of salt and pepper, and boiled it up. And then the lady went and said, I'm just saying my magic spell over this, and it's going to taste good. Do you think if you boiled up just onions in a big saucepan, that it would taste nice? No. So the lady, when it was boiling nicely, she went over, got a spoon, tasted the soup and said, oh, this is coming along very nicely now. It is quite good. It does need a little bit of something else now to make it really, really good. If there were some carrots around now, maybe I could improve it still. So the carrots person said, I can give you some carrots. And the carrots went into it, boiled them up for a while. The lady went through the thing again, tasted and says, oh, that's twice as good as the last time. It could do with a little bit of something else. Would anyone have potatoes? That would sort of thicken it up nicely. And suddenly someone says, well, I have some potatoes. We can throw those in. And it went on and on like that until everybody had contributed something to the stew. And when everyone had contributed all the different vegetables to the stew, it really did taste wonderful. Do you think that person had magic powers? No, no. Anyone think she had? She didn't have magic powers, but she had an awful lot of wisdom because she realized what people were worried about. They were afraid to be generous. And she realized if she could find a way to make them comfortable parting with what they have, everyone would be better. So in a way, she had really magic powers because she got people to part with things. That's the only magic power she had, though. Thank you, children. You're very good for coming down. We are going to have a music item now. Well, one of them. I don't know. Okay, no. Sorry. Tell you what, we'll just start with our first reader and we'll have our music one on. Our first reader is Jennifer.
Morning. I still have three sheets of paper because I couldn't decide what to read this morning. I'm going to read a poem called Good Bones by Maggie Smith, one of my favorites, and I've changed the tenses because I'm no longer an active duty mother. I'm an empty nester, so I've changed the tenses to match that. Good Bones by Maggie Smith. Life is short, though I kept this for my children. Life is short, and I've shortened mine in 1,000 delicious, ill-advised ways. 1,000 deliciously ill-advised ways I've kept from my children. The world is at least 50% terrible. And that's a conservative estimate, though I kept this from my children. For every bird, there is a stone thrown at a bird. For every loved child, a child broken, bagged, sunk in a lake. Life is short, and the world is at least half terrible. And for every kind stranger, there is one who would break you, though I kept this from my children. I'm trying to sell them the world, or I tried to sell them the world. Any decent realtor walking you through a real shithole chirps on about the good bones. This place could be beautiful, right? You could make this place beautiful. Thanks.
Our next reader is Madeline.
I'm also going to read poems, three, but don't panic, two of them are really, really short. I thought we'd just have something about autumn with no meaning other than it's the autumn. I've always preferred the autumn to the spring, and the last poem I'm going to read is Keats, and it's the first lines of that, but I'm going to start with the short ones. The first one is by somebody called T.E. Holm, who died age 34 in 1917, and he wrote this in 1908. And it's supposed to be one of the very earliest examples of modern poetry. A touch of cold in the autumn night, I walked abroad and saw the ruddy moon lean over a hedge like a red-faced farmer. I did not stop to speak, but nodded, and round about were the wistful stars with white faces like town children. The next one is even shorter, and it's written, it's called November Night, and it's written by an American poet called Adelaide Crapsey, who died at 36 in 1914. Listen, with faint dry sound, like steps of passing ghosts, the leaves, frost-crisped, break from the trees and fall. These poets were all very young, and this one is Keats, and he was the youngest. He died, actually, he was born on the 31st of October, interestingly enough, 1795, and died aged 25 in 1821. But this one I was made to learn when I was in school, and I remember bits of it. Other bits aren't so good. To autumn. Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run, to bend with apples the mossed cottage trees, and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core, to swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel, to set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees, until they think warm days will never cease, for summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells. Who hath not seen thee oft amid thy store? Sometimes whoever seeks abroad may find thee sitting careless on a granary floor, thy hair soft lifted by the winnowing wind, or on a half-reaped furrow sound asleep, drowsed with the fume of poppies, while thy hook spares the neck swath and all its twined flowers. And sometimes like a gleaner dost thou keep steady thy laden head across a brook, or by a cider press with patient look thou watchest the last oozings hours by hours. Where are the songs of spring? Aye, where are they? Think not of them. Thou hast thy music too. While barred clouds bloom from the soft dying day and touch the stubble plains with rosy hue, then in a wailful choir the small gnats mourn among the river sallows, borne aloft or sinking as the light wind lives or dies. And full-grown lambs loud bleat from hilly bourn. Hedge crickets sing, and now with treble soft the redbreast whistles from a garden croft, and gathering swallows twitter in the skies.
Thank you, Madeline. And just to embarrass Madeline, Friday was a special birthday for Madeline. So we're just going to have a very quick happy birthday for her. Andrew is our next reader, and he's going to read a piece about a cellist, and then we're going to hear the piece of music that's referred to in the poem.
Good morning. So my reading is from a book called Bittersweet, and it's by Susan Cain. And it's entitled, How to Turn Sorrow into Creativity, Beauty and Love. And really it's about something that we were familiar with in 1992 and is happening again in the world, and how maybe each of us can make a difference, because this one person made a difference. The Cellist of Sarajevo. One night, I dreamed that I was meeting my friend, a poet named Mariana, in Sarajevo, the city of love. I woke up confused. Sarajevo, a symbol of love? Weren't Bosnia and its capital, Sarajevo, the site of one of the bloodiest civil wars and ethnic cleansings of the 20th century? Then I remembered Vedran Samolovic, the cellist of Sarajevo. It's May 28, 1992, and Sarajevo is under siege. For centuries, Bosniaks, Croats, and Serbs have lived together in the city of street carts and pastry shops, gliding swans in parkland ponds, Ottoman mosques, and Eastern Orthodox cathedrals. A city of three religions, three peoples, yet until recently no one paid too much attention to who was who. They knew, but they didn't know. They preferred to see one another as neighbors who met for coffee or kebabs, took classes at the same universities, sometimes got married and had children. But now civil war and ethnic cleansing of Bosnia's Muslims. Men on the hills flanking the city have cut the electricity and water supply. The 1984 Olympic Stadium has burned down, its playing fields turned into makeshift graveyards. The apartment buildings are pockmarked from the mortar assaults. The traffic lights are broken, the streets are quiet. The only sound is the crackling of gunfire. Until this moment, when the strains of Albinoni's Adagio in G minor filled the pedestrian street outside a bombed out bakery. And that's the piece of music we're listening to. It's haunting, it's exquisite, it's infinitely sad. Vedran Samolovic, lead cellist of the Sarajevo Opera Orchestra, is playing it in honor of 22 people killed yesterday by a mortar shell as they lined up for bread. Samolovic was nearby when the shell exploded. He helped take care of the wounded. Now he's returned to the scene of the carnage, dressed as if for a night at the opera house, in a formal white shirt and black tails. He sits amidst the rubble on a plastic white chair, his cello propped between his legs. The yearning notes of the Adagio float up into the sky. All around him, the rifles fire, the shelling booms, the machine guns crackle. Samolovic keeps on playing. He'll do this for 22 days, one day for each person killed at the bakery. Somehow the bullets never touch him. This is a city built in a valley ringed by mountains from which snipers aim at starving citizens in search of bread. Some people wait for hours to cross the street, then dart across like hunted deer. But here's a man, sitting still in an open square, dressed in concert finery, as if he has all the time in the world. You ask me, am I crazy for playing the cello in a war zone, he says. Why don't you ask them if they're crazy for shelling Sarajevo? His gestures reverberate throughout the city, over the airwaves. Soon he'll find expression in a novel, a film. But before that, during the darkest days of the siege, Samolovic will inspire other musicians to take to the streets with their own instruments. They don't play martial music to rouse the troops against the snipers or pop tunes to lift the people's spirits. They play the Albinoni. The destroyers attack with bombs and guns, and the musicians respond with the most bittersweet music they know. We're not combatants, call the violinists. We're not victims either at the violas. We're just humans, sing the cellos. Just humans, flawed and beautiful and aching for love. A few months later, the civil war and ethnic cleansing rage on, and the foreign correspondent Alan Little watches as a procession of 40,000 civilians emerge from a forest. They've been trudging through the woods for 48 hours straight, fleeing an attack. Among them is an 80-year-old man. He looks desperate, exhausted. The man approaches Little, and Little asks if he's seen his wife. They were separated during the long march, the man says. Little hasn't seen her, but even the but ever the journalist asks whether the man wouldn't mind identifying himself as either Muslim or Kraut. And the man's answer, Little says years later in a gorgeous BBC segment, shames him even now as he recalls it across the decades. I am, said the old man, a musician.
Thank you.
Our next reader is Noli.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to read from one of the older Thich Nhat Hanh books. He first published this book in 1988, and he was one of the first people to bring mindfulness to the West. He also established a place called Plum Village in France, where you can go on retreats for mindfulness, etc. So the heading of this is Taking Care of the Apple Tree in Your Yard. As we sit down next to a stream, we can listen to its laughter and watch its sparkling waters, noticing the pebbles glistening and the fresh green plants nearby. And we may be overcome with happiness. We are one with the stream's freshness, purity, and clarity. But in just an instant, we may find we've had enough. Our heart is troubled, and we think of other things. We are no longer at one with the stream. It is of no use to sit in a peaceful forest if our mind is lost in the city. When we live with a child or a friend, their freshness and warmth can relax us. But if our heart is not with them, their precious presence is neglected and they no longer exist. We must be aware of them to appreciate their value, to allow them to be our happiness. If through carelessness and forgetfulness, we become dissatisfied with them and begin asking too much of them or reprimanding them, we will lose them. Only after they are gone will we realize their preciousness and feel regret. But once they are gone, all our regrets are in vain. Around us, life bursts forth with miracles. A glass of water, a ray of sunshine, a leaf, a caterpillar, a flower, laughter, raindrops. If you live in awareness, it is easy to see miracles everywhere. Each human being is a multiplicity of miracles. Eyes that see thousands of colors, shapes, and forms. Ears that hear a bee flying or a thunderclap, a brain that ponders a speck of dust as easily as the entire cosmos, a heart that beats in rhythm with the heartbeat of all beings. When we are tired and feel discouraged by life's daily struggles, we may not notice these miracles, but they are always there. Have a look at the apple tree in your yard. Look at it with complete attention. It is truly a miracle. If you notice it, you will take good care of it, and you too are part of its miraculousness. Even after caring for it for only a week, its leaves are already greener and shinier. It is exactly the same with people who are around you. Under the influence of awareness, you become more attentive, understanding, and loving. And your presence not only nourishes you and makes you lovelier, it enhances them as well. Our entire society can be changed by one person's peaceful.
Liz has a reading.
This reading is an abridged version of a newspaper article written by Colin McCann at the start of the Israel-Hamas conflict. Like most of us, I didn't know what to say, not to my family, not to my colleagues, not to myself. So early on Monday morning, I texted my friends, Bassam Aramin and Rami Elhanan, whom I had written about in my novel, A Paragon, asking them how they were doing in the terrible turmoil that unfolded over the weekend. One is Palestinian, the other is Israeli. One lives in Jericho, the other in Haifa. Having both lost their daughters to violence, they live in the holy land of grief. I mentioned to them that I thought my speechlessness was a statement in itself. This was an obvious cop-out on my behalf, and I knew it. I went on to ask them, how are they responding? Bassam came back to me within a half an hour. He quoted a Mahmoud Darwish poem. Tomorrow the war will end. The leaders will shake hands. The old woman will keep waiting for her martyred son. The girl will wait for her beloved husband. And those children will wait for their hero father. I don't know who sold our homeland, but I saw who paid the price. Within 1 minute, Rami, his Israeli friend, had sent a teardrop emoji. The responses struck me deeply. They were simple, but then again, in this particular conflict, simplicity is an achievement. Bassam was saying that the war will end. Peace, in his eyes, is an inevitability. Time changes all things. Who believed that 20 years after the Holocaust, there could be an Israeli embassy in Berlin and a German embassy in Tel Aviv? Who dreamt of the Berlin Wall coming down? Who thought that there would be relative quiet in the streets of Belfast? Bassam is not a sentimental man. He spent 7 years in Israeli prisons. He lost his cherished daughter to an Israeli bullet. He is, however, a man who fits into the Gramscian construct of being a pessimist of the intellect and an optimist of the will. In other words, these are the darkest times, but it is the job of Bassam to believe there is a possible change lurking in the beyond. To refuse to believe so would be to die. In some ways, he is cursed by hope. Rami, too, is cursed by his sense of hope. As an Israeli, he is aware that the occupation has corrupted his country. His heart breaks for all, Israeli, Palestinian, or others, who are forced to visit his country of grief. Rami and Bassam have a construct when they travel the world together talking about their plight. We don't need to love each other, they say. We don't even need to like each other, although we hope we could. But the one thing we do need to do to prevent us speaking from 6 feet underground is to understand one another. This is the most crucial thing. We need to know one another. It's not enough, but it's something.
Robin has a reading.
Good morning. When I was a very young boy and an altar boy, my parish priest was a bishop and my parish church was a cathedral, and we had long, long ceremonies and all that. And I always remember there was a suggestion at the beginning for shorter versions, read in italics. And you know, I'm sure you all know, they never did. So this reading I have today, which is by Good Vibes, Good Life by Vex King, it's an article on gratitude. I decided I would italicize it. I'm not even sure if there's such a word, but I'm going to edit it in order to make it short enough for us here, I hope, without losing the substance. So, being thankful is one of the simplest and yet most powerful habits you can cultivate. By counting your blessings daily, you can begin to condition your mind to look for the good in everything around you. Soon enough, you will unconsciously begin to see the bright side of things and feel better about life. You can't feel bad when you're feeling thankful. As simple as showing gratitude sounds, most people struggle with it. It's much easier to focus on burdens than on gifts, to devote your attention to the things you don't have rather than the things you do have. I was once studying some of the most successful individuals on this planet, and one phrase really stuck me: greatness starts with being grateful. I didn't think too much of it at the time, but as I've grown older, I've begun to understand its value. I realized that you can't feel joy without being thankful. Being thankful is a vital component of happiness. Furthermore, by expressing gratitude, we not only transform our vibrational state to become more magnetic to the good things, but we also become able to put things into perspective. We go through each day constantly comparing ourselves to others, and most of us rarely acknowledge that we have what others may desire. We also tend to compare ourselves to those we consider more fortunate, rather than those who are less fortunate. Just think of the amount of people who have to live through war on a daily basis, but who are completely safe from such troubles, and many more that we hear about in the news. It's easy to say thanks without really meaning it. The key to showing gratitude is to feel thankful. When practicing gratitude, imagine how difficult your life would be without that particular thing you're showing thanks for. It will produce strong feelings and emotions, and this is how you can get into a powerful state of gratitude. Remember, there might be many things in the world that are going wrong, yet there are absolutely many things in the world that are going right. The more you count your blessings, the more blessings you'll have to count. Too many of us direct our energy towards our fears. I'm not saying your problems don't exist, but try instead to focus your energy on solutions to these problems. The universe is abundant in all areas. The illusion of fear is the only limitation we have.
I think we've time for another reader. Janet, would you like to read?
Good morning, everybody. It might be a little simplistic, but I'm quite upset at what is happening in the world. And in my simplistic attempt to understand it, I think that when people lose sight of the very essence of them and their very being, there's trouble ahead. I know there are many reasons for this happening, but the consequences of losing sight of your essence and your being are detrimental. I'm reading out of Sister Stan's book. It's titled Finding Peace, and I'm going to read a few of the words put together by a man called Liam O'Moonlay, excuse the pronunciation, and he is a band member in the Hothouse Flowers. He speaks of his art, and he speaks of his sense of being, and I found it very comforting. Every time I cross the threshold of where I eat and sleep, out into the air and the sky, I feel something. I'll just push this down a bit. My body feels it. It is as if the stars and the sky connect with what is in me. In autumn, the smell of fallen leaves deepens the experience of breathing for me. I put one foot ahead of the other, as did my people and their people before them. I cease the following of any train of thought, but rather allow the thought be and fade. The light of the morning sun feels vivid and nourishing to my being, and I feel buoyed by the light. I walk at an easy pace, slow and even. This has been a great source of peace for me, to bear witness to the coming of the day as a being of the day. Sometimes at night, in winter, when I walk, I let go of my defense against the cold. I let the cold in, and I become the night. My hands by my side feel the cold, and my body no longer feels it as something to run from. I have paint, ink, charcoal, and paper. Often by the fire at home, I will play with the color and the nature of the materials. I let them lead, then I might lead, then they lead again, a dance of creation. I have no goal but to allow a balance between how I feel, what I see, what I feel, and how I see. 2 days later, perhaps, I will take great pleasure at gazing at the work. I might gaze at the sky and the clouds. There are many words for God and many stories and ways to adore him. I feel blessed to have the air coursing through me, to have the billions of miracles it takes for me to be here, occurring as I write and as you listen. Thank you.
Now just sit back, relaxed, and listen to this treat.
Thank you.
We have our next hymn now, hymn number 151, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. And maybe we're really running short of time. We could do the offertory while this is going on. Hymn number... Our notices. First of all, thank you to our readers and musicians. It's always fascinating the different items people bring to this service. And particular thank you to Shari and Josh. That piece was absolutely wonderful. Of course, it was just something they threw together at the last minute, you know. Fair trade tea and coffee are served downstairs. Do please join us. There's a new copy of November's Uskult magazine on the table outside. Two things to draw your attention to. One is the managing committee notice about renewal of voting membership. And the other is the 11th of November, Josh's Mind Travels in the Church on that Saturday evening. If anyone is of a mind on Wednesday coming, the 1st of November, at 6 o'clock, and it is in the City Assembly Rooms, which are on South William Street, Dr. David Caron, who specialises in stained glass, has written a book about someone called Michael Healy. He's launching that book, and anyone who would like to go to that is invited. David Caron has spoken extensively about our window here. We're going to have our carol service on the 17th of December, and that's one of the favourite Sundays of the year. And why not make it a special day? We have a bake sale, a book sale, and a raffle
If anyone has prizes for the raffles they would like to donate, we would take those. And we need to put our thinking caps on about, and this will be discussed at the managing committee, the next one, about charities for December. We have always had one Sunday a month where the offertory is donated to charity. COVID sort of interrupted that, and also the fact that because of COVID, people have begun to make donations to the church from, you know, websites as well. So it's not the physical donations in the church anymore. But last year, what we did was at our favourite two sort of most important services, the Carol service and Christmas Day, we donated those collections to charities. But we need to think about what we're doing and also about giving the gifts for under the Christmas tree. Something we love to do is bring a gift, wrap it, put it under the Christmas tree, and they were brought to various charities. And the last 2 years, we've come to realise that these aren't really suitable for the charities any longer. I don't know why, but they just seem to have moved on. They want gift tokens or Xbox games, and Xbox games don't sit well with us. But we can have a think about it, and if anyone has any ideas of what we could do, something different, we'll bring them to the managing committee. That's it. We're going to have our final hymn number 29. Joyful, joyful, we adore thee. Hymn number 29. Our blessing. May the light around us guide our footsteps and hold us to the best and most righteous we seek to be. May the darkness around us nurture our dreams and give us rest so that we may give ourselves to our work in the world. Let us seek to remember the wholeness of our lives, the weaving of light and shadow in the great and astonishing dance in which we move. Amen.